As Rhode Island battles a stagnant economy and is tied with Nevada for the highest unemployment rate in the nation, many people are turning to schools and colleges for a workforce that can lift the state out of difficult times. So how are educators rising to meet this challenge, and what do employers need the most? These are some of the issues we'll explore during Policy and Pino, Rhode Island Public Radio's ongoing discussion of top state issues. I'm Elizabeth Harrison, and our panelists are Rhode Island Deputy Commissioner of Education David Abbott, who's a former public school teacher and an attorney, and he's been with the State Department of Education for more than a decade now, working on initiatives like stronger teacher evaluations, new graduation requirements, and developing education policy for the state. Catherine Bergeron, Dean of the College at Brown University, she spearheaded an effort to reconsider the goal of a liberal arts education, and she's worked to change advising for students who are looking ahead to life after Brown. To my right, here is John Hazen White, Jr., president of Taco, Inc. in Cranston, a manufacturing company with 500 employees and its own education and innovation center to train workers in everything from basic manufacturing jobs to MBA courses. And we also have Stephen Kitchen, vice president for corporate education and training at New England Institute of Technology. He runs a training center that works directly with businesses to provide worker training. He's also a member of the Governor's Workforce Board Advisory Committee. So to all of our panelists and to the audience here, thank you so much for being here. Now, Rhode Island has for many years struggled with some of the lowest test scores in New England when it comes to national testing. On the latest round of state tests, just 40% of high school juniors couldn't even do well enough to be considered partially proficient, and that was an improvement, a pretty significant improvement, but clearly it's not nearly enough. And this is also a state where nearly half of the adults have no college degree. So David Abbott from the Rhode Island Department of Education, start us off here. Give me a sense of the history. How did we get here?
Well, so your numbers are correct, and it is a pretty dismal situation. And, you know, Rhode Island is right at the national mean for most measures, and we're actually doing a lot better on reading, in the English language arts, reading and writing. We're actually leading New England in a couple of those areas, but we always focus on math, and for good reason, especially if we're talking about workforce development. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the things that we need to look at is how many of our kids are we retaining compared to a lot of other states, and the graduation rate has actually gone up almost 10 percentage points over the last 12 years. So we're testing a lot more kids, and we're expecting more of more kids. But what we know is that a lot of our high school juniors who are taking the NECAP or the New England Common Assessment have not even been exposed to some of the math that they're getting on the mm-hmm. test. And so there's clearly a misalignment in a lot of our districts in terms of what kids are getting access to and what they're being tested on. And I'm sure as the hour goes on, we'll all talk about access in a lot of different ways, because it's one of the primary challenges that we have in Rhode Island. And it's interesting, you know, we were on another panel a few months ago, and there are some pretty significant gaps, especially on the public side of public education. I hope we get a chance to get into that, because there really isn't a light at the end of the tunnel for a lot of kids. And you know, we talk about being college and career ready, and for some students, you know, they're probably not going to need a baccalaureate degree to become career ready. Those are not all of the careers out there, mm-hmm. and you know, on some level, and I may get disagreed on the point I'm about to make, but you know, on some level, all post-secondary education is career readiness, and there are very few people that can afford to get an education and don't have to worry about using that as an entry into some kind of life-sustaining wage, or you know, something that's truly a career and not a job. Mm-hmm. So, you know, on our side, we're trying to raise the expectations. And, you know, the Board of Regents passed high school graduation requirements in 2003. And they they were put off twice, and so they so-called count for the first time in 2014. And all of a sudden, you're seeing a tremendous surge of activity in our school systems in terms of bringing ramp-up programs and supports to kids. And, you know, unfortunately, and, you know, I know that the concept of high-stakes testing is very controversial, but without accountability, you tend not to see movement. And, you know, as the commissioner has said, sometimes you need to make the pain of the status quo greater than the pain of change. And I think that's what we're going through right now.
Is what we're asking schools to do now that big of a change, asking them to get all students to be college and career ready? Isn't that what we always wanted public schools to do?
Well, I think the expectation of who we're talking about has changed significantly. I mean, the days are long gone and will never return when you could enter life with basically an eighth grade education, get a job locally in a mill, you know, a life-sustaining wage. You know, those days are gone, even in the manufacturing industry, as I'm sure John will attest. You know, we're not seeing careers that you can enter with a high school education, never mind an eighth grade, you know, basic literacy level of learning. So the expectation has gone up, and the jobs have shifted. You know, so we know that roughly a third of the jobs that will be emerging in Rhode Island over the next 10 to 12 years will require baccalaureate or higher. About a third are not careers. They're going to be entry-level jobs. And the other third are going to require something more than high school and something less than a baccalaureate. And that's one of those huge gaps that we've got in Rhode Island, is there just aren't the pathways open to students for those kind of those middle jobs where, you know, if I just stay in school and I'm in a multiple pathway and I'm getting some career training, that I've got somewhere to go to get the next, you know, couple of years of training that put me into one of those careers that doesn't require a baccalaureate degree. You know, TACO, you know, Electric Boat, we've got examples where private industry has stepped up and filled the gap. New England Institute of Technology on the private side, fantastic facilities. You know, where is that on the public side? It's really missing in Rhode Island.
Now, Catherine Bergeron from Brown University, David Abbott says, in a sense, all education is career training. Do you agree with that?
That's an interesting point of view. and I could go in a couple of different directions with that question. And one thing I was thinking about, since we're in this historic building, is to think a little bit about the history of the kind of liberal arts education that is represented at a place like Brown University. What we think of as a liberal arts education in America is actually a 19th century adaptation of a classical ideal of education. Right. So, and why did it take the form that it did, and when it did? Because of the great technological expansion of the U.S. in the mid-19th century, the westward expansion of the territories that required new kinds of technological knowledge, the railroads, the mines, agricultural industry required a new workforce, and it required, therefore, people who were educated in a different way. So the fourth president of Brown, Francis Wayland, actually imagined a new kind of education that would open up the curriculum, make it more practical. Students were not required to study Greek and Latin anymore and the higher mathematics, but things that would actually help them in the professions that they wanted to do. Isn't that interesting? Because the same education that we now sometimes like to talk about as being impractical actually has practical roots.
Well, let me pose that as a question to you. In today's, with the profusion of new technologies that we have today, how are the liberal arts still relevant?
Very relevant. Well, first of all, I would say that development of the curriculum has continued. It's never stopped. Colleges and universities are always adapting what they're teaching to the kinds of students and the needs that the students have, and that goes on to this very day. But I think there's one enduring aspect to the idea of the liberal arts that's really worth pointing out, and that often gets lost in these kinds of conversations when we're talking about practical value, and that is its capacity to teach you to think and to see the world from more than one perspective. Right, the capacity to inspire curiosity, the ability to ask questions, to become comfortable with the unknown. This is a very important aspect. Maybe you could say it's the capacity to learn how you learn when you actually don't know what is being asked of you. These are skills of a higher order that I think are extremely important, and you could say are ever more important at a moment now when we are in a world of rapid change.
Technology is something that obviously is a very important aspect of the education at the New England Institute of Technology. Stephen Kitchen, tell me how today's landscape is transforming career and technical education.
Well, for us at the college, everything is driven by our mission and purpose. As the dean would attest, when you go through your accreditation process, the first thing that the accreditors look for is a well-stated mission and purpose of the institution. Since 1940, our mission and purpose hasn't changed, and that is to address the demands of the labor market that exist in southeastern New England. New England Tech has always positioned itself with programs that had a direct application to the world of work.
Whether, so as the labor market has changed, how have you had to adapt?
We've adapted dramatically. For example, in the example I was going to use, in 1940, if anyone in the room can name the first program at New England Institute of Technology, I can give you a prize if you'd like. But it was for the rubber and plastics industry. And the rubber and plastic industry, as we all know, didn't stay here in Rhode Island very long, or it stayed long enough for that program to move on, and radio and television repair became the next big thing at New England Tech. When was the last time anyone here had their television repaired? So the point is that those impacts have had an impact on our education, as has the economic climate here in Rhode Island. 80,000 Rhode Islanders of the 500,000 plus who participate in the labor market here are in the healthcare field. Mm-hmm. So now New England Institute of Technology has eight associate, bachelor's, and even a master's degree program in healthcare occupations. The landscape has changed us. The landscape has changed us in terms of IT. Information technology and the need for networking, engineering, support personnel has forced the institution to address that need in the marketplace. So we don't exist as an institution without that demand side equation. And that goes to mission and purpose of the institution.
And we're also seeing, David Abbott, classrooms where students have tablets instead of textbooks. Chalkboards are going away and we have whiteboards. Talk about some of the ways that technology is changing classrooms on the K-12 side.
Too slowly is the short version there. And, you know, it's a landscape that I would say is growing in small islands. And there really isn't a statewide investment. An ongoing investment. Technology is expensive. It's not just about the tools that you use to access outside of the building. It's the software development. It's the training for teachers. It's the maintenance of the equipment. It's, you know, getting really broadband access into classrooms where multiple people can be accessing the internet simultaneously, whether it's for testing or instructional purposes. So I wish I could sit here and say that Rhode Island is a leader in that area, but we're really not.
We're going to take a quick break here. You're listening to a special broadcast of Policy in Peno recorded at the Providence Athenaeum. We're exploring how the state is retooling education for 21st century jobs. Welcome back to a special broadcast of Policy in Peno, recorded before a live audience at the Providence Athenaeum. We're talking about how schools are changing to create a workforce for the 21st century. And joining us is David Abbott, Rhode Island Deputy Education Commissioner, Catherine Bergeron of Brown University, John Hazen-White Jr. of TACO, Inc., and Stephen Kitchen from New England Institute of Technology. I'd like to pick up where we left off, David Abbott. If technology is very slowly entering Rhode Island's classrooms, how will our students be able to keep up when they arrive in a workplace where, you know, basic computer skills are a requirement for almost every job?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. And Rhode Island has really focused so far on bringing access into schools and public libraries and mm-hmm. And so that's where the emphasis has been. There's a $20 million technology bond. So I don't want anyone to think that any of our listeners to think nothing's going on. It just can't happen quickly enough. And so what we are seeing, there are two virtual charter high schools opening in the fall where education is being flipped, where kids are getting content through the internet and working with their teachers to better understand the material and work in small groups, as opposed to simply being in a classroom in a static way, having content delivered to them, and then struggling with the work at home. And so it's going to be really interesting to see some of these innovative new practices, how they take hold. But, you know, technology by itself isn't the answer. It's technology in the hands of teachers who are skilled in the use of technology as a pedagogical tool and not just as a way of accessing. I mean, just walk the streets, go into any high school cafeteria, and it really doesn't matter, urban, suburban, every kid is wired, you know. So that's not the issue. It's really how do we use technology to intelligently advance the practice of teaching.
And Brown University is also developing some online courses. Catherine Bergeron, you're involved in that. What about quality? Are you concerned about quality when courses become online rather than person-to-person?
We're always concerned about the quality of courses, no matter what the delivery method. So I think one of the things that we have to think about when we experiment with new modes of delivery is, are what are the standards for this activity? You know, how do you actually determine what level of rigor is required in this new space? But we don't know a lot about the space, so our experiments are just that at the moment. We have signed on for a small experiment with that platform called Coursera that is out from Silicon Valley. A couple of computer engineers at Stanford started this company, and they began signing on partners in institutions across the country. I'm vexed that the Berklee College of Music is alphabetically above Brown University if you go to the Coursera website. But there are three faculty members who are piloting this project. One is Arnold Weinstein, a longtime member of the comparative literature faculty, who's doing a course called The Fiction of Relationship. There's a course on archaeology. I think it's called Archaeology's Dirty Little Secrets that is being taught by Susan Alcock, and a course by Philip Klein on linear algebra and its applications to computer science, a rather more advanced class. What has been amazing to me so far about the development of these classes is what it is teaching the faculty members about the new kinds of pedagogy required to make something happen in this space. So it's very much related to your point. These experiments aren't really about the technology. It's about actually maybe rethinking the way that you have taught in order to get the same kind of thing across. And I think it's very exciting for the faculty members who are trying it out, thinking about new ways. They are dedicated teachers in their own right, and they're now actually saying, oh, well, if I'm going to do it in this modality for 32,000 students who have signed up for this course, I have to actually come up with another way of preparing and delivering and even assessing the work of students. So I think My feeling is that any investment in education is an important piece of what the university is doing. So this kind of investment in this experiment is going to be valuable for Brown, even if we decide to stop doing it.
Okay. John Hazen-White, I'd like to bring you into this conversation a little bit. You've been listening to what everyone has to say. You're an employer. What are the skills that you most need from employees, from potential employees?
Yeah, what I was thinking about listening to these folks was that I think I'm beginning to learn some things that I haven't even understood up until now. And as education applies to a company like mine, we are, when I began running it, which was 20 years ago, it was a very basic manufacturing company, as they were through the, you know, mid 1900s and whatnot. And we began to invest in the company to fix it. And it presented a whole bunch of opportunities and problems dealing with educating our workforce because they weren't equipped for some of the basic challenges that that we had.
What sorts of things were missing?
We have and had at the time and have now a very, very a workforce which is heavily immigrant populated, a tremendous number of Asians and Hispanics. And their education levels were, in many cases, fairly low. In fact, if any, we had a lot, we have still an awful lot of first generation immigrants. So we had to come about this a little bit different. This is what I was beginning to understand as I listened to you. You're talking about educating kids as they grow. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a thing about maturity and age that provides the opportunity to educate people a little bit differently as a matter of their own desire. Mm-hmm. Kids don't get that, maybe. I don't know. I'm just thinking about this. But certainly older people do, and particularly as it pertains to keeping their job or their career growing and developing. So we came out about this a little bit differently, and that was to begin to educate maybe poorly educated older people. And so we began by teaching, and I think this is really actually very important, we began by teaching work-related, job-related skills. Blueprint reading, gauge reading, English as a second language, very basic math, just to understand as we began to invest in automation and decent equipment for people to be able to understand what they were working with, you know. Here's what we learned, and this is really important, I think, as it pertains to what we're doing and continue to do. The more people learned, the more we found they wanted to learn. And so lo and behold, they began to ask for non-work-related things, you know, marketing for the non-marketing types and accounting for whatever, these sorts of things. And we began to provide anything people wanted because as I grew up, I tell people this all the time. I'm not really a businessman. I don't have a business education. I'm an English major. As was my father and my son. And if there's one thing I learned in my educational life, which was interesting, was that it's fun to learn how to learn because it's something that never ends. So what I expect and hope for the people that work at Taco, and it doesn't matter if it's Takeo or any other place like that, is that they want to grow and develop with us, you know, because we're going to grow and develop, you know, and there's nothing I'd rather have than the same group of folks doing it. So if we can provide an opportunity for people to continue to learn, to want to learn, it's what you're all about, right?
You were an English major.
Right, I'm still learning, but and what you're dealing with at lower levels, you know, I think in the school system is the most valuable thing I can imagine, giving to an individual who's going to go into the workforce, is the ability to learn how to learn. Mm-hmm. That to me it's more important than, because then they can go and learn technical things if that's what's going to happen for them. They can. But I love to have learners mm-hmm. at Taco. Mm-hmm. It's how we've grown and developed. Now, I get 500 people. I actually now have 700 people. I just discovered that yesterday. But anyway, it's interesting because they're the same. Those 500 you were talking about, they're the same 500 people that were there 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we have less than 0.5% turnover rate. So if I lose two people, it's a lot. And they're the people that came, because when I began running the company, it was broke, basically. And those are the same people that helped fix it. And they did it by learning and growing and developing. And it's an amazing thing. So
So, David Abbott, learning how to learn, is that the same as what you're talking about when you say that students need to be college and career ready?
It is. You know, when we talk about career readiness, sometimes the shorthand we use is the ability to learn a skill that you don't currently know that you need. And that's really what we're shooting for because, you know, my dad worked for an insurance company for 30 years. And, you know, now we know statistically, you know, I'm my, what, third career. So, you know, teacher, then litigator, and, you know, now a bureaucrat. You know, that's the norm now, that people are switching careers. And that's just as true on the technical side. So when I was referring earlier to the light at the end of the tunnel, I think one of the things that we've really missed is this kind of idea that as you fall behind in our system, and too many of our kids, as you opened with, Elizabeth, have, you know, it's this, well, let's provide remedial education and help them catch up. And what we know is much more effective is learning skills in context, especially if it can be in a context that has some career readiness real world to you. Now, how do you, just what John was saying, you know, about the maturity, you know, I think there's a missed opportunity that we can bring that kind of lure into secondary education, and it doesn't have to be just about adult learners because, you know, our kids in high school are thinking about life on, you know, post-high school. And, you know, if we could be, rather than, okay, you know, take eighth grade math for the third time, you know, we've got some great career and tech teachers in our schools that are teaching algebra, you know, and displacement and geometry in automotive classes and in CAD classes. And you know, that really gets kids' attention and holds them in. And if there's somewhere to go with that post-secondary on top of that, okay, now you can keep going. There's a year 13, there's a year 14, and guess what? There's a job at the end of that, which is the one thing we haven't talked about, is it's one thing to prepare the workforce, but prepare the workforce for what? Mm-hmm. Because the one area where Rhode Island's doing a very good job is preparing folks for careers with baccalaureate and above, mm-hmm. and we're losing, you know, a lot of them because there aren't the careers here to hold them. So it's a, mm-hmm. you know, there are two parts to the equation, and they have to happen simultaneously and be a little more organic. And, you know, the mm-hmm. it's, you know, one can't happen without the other.
And Stephen Kitchen from New England Institute of Technology, this is a place where students are being prepared directly for the workforce. How have you found, what have you found are the most, are the best ways to do that? I mean, are you, is it students in a classroom? Is it hands-on learning? How do you really make, produce a student who becomes then a worker at the end of a program?
Well, first, to make sure that the program's focused on the outcome, to make sure that you're preparing the person for the career that you've selected, number one. Number two, that we have 50% or more of our education happens in a laboratory or happens in a clinical or an internship or externship environment, so that for multiple reasons, and many of them have no direct requirement for that, but we found that over time that students learn best in that environment where they're applying the things that they've experienced in a classroom and taking it in a lab and saying, okay, let's apply this technique. Let's see what in manufacturing engineering, how we use this CAD system to do this particular drawing or whatever it may be. So 50% of our education is hands-on. Second, the clinical component. For many of our careers, they have externships, internships, and clinical components, which again do two things. Give the student the opportunity to see the environment that they're going to be working in, and give the employer an opportunity to see what potential employees they may have. In many of our clinical experiences, employers take the opportunity to see what that person's going to bring to the table, and then they retain them. And I want to echo what David said. You know, we can talk a lot about what education can do to prepare people for the world of work, We've got to have a serious conversation about job generation in Rhode Island and how we create an environment in this state that creates entrepreneurs and allows them to succeed without penalty in this environment. Mr. White deserves a lot of credit for staying here in very difficult and challenging times. But it seems to me one of the conversations we're failing to have is the job generation side of the equation. I know this is about education, but truly, we can educate till the cows come home. But if there aren't opportunities for our people, our graduates of all of our institutions of higher education and other programs, we are going to continue to experience one of the few states that lost 26,000 people from the last census. And we're threatened now with the possibility of losing a congressional seat as a result of our decreased population. You know, you don't grow as a state. No state will grow with a declining population. That is an economic contradiction. It will not happen. You cannot grow in that environment.
Well, John Hazen-White, do you want to respond to that? I mean, you're a part of the business community. Isn't part of the problem that the workers that you have at your fingertips here in the state are not well enough prepared?
Oh, I suppose. Yeah, I suppose. But I have a different attitude. Now, again, let's go back to what I said. It's a little difficult for me to compare to other people, but we don't lose people. So I've got this core group of people that we just keep working with, as opposed to having to bring new ones in. And so I don't know what that would be like, but I think, you know, there are people that are not equipped to go into the workforce in a way that in any aspect of the workforce without further training. It's a matter of who does that. We've chosen to do it ourselves.
And do you think that's a model that could work? Should other businesses do what you're doing? Is that realistic?
It's difficult because it is expensive. It's costly, but I think that I'm a big proponent of in-house, sort of, I don't want to say controlled, but sort of managed education. Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a short break here. You're listening to Policy and Pino, recorded live at the Providence Athenaeum. I'm Elizabeth Harrison, and this is Rhode Island Public Radio. You're listening to a special broadcast of Policy and Pino on Rhode Island Public Radio. I'm Elizabeth Harrison, and we're talking about how schools are changing to create a workforce for the 21st century. Our panel is David Abbott, Rhode Island's Deputy Commissioner of Education, Catherine Bergeron, Dean of the College from Brown University, John Hazen-White, Jr. of Teco, Inc., and Stephen Kitchen from New England Institute of Technology. I'd like to pick up where we left off a little bit, talking about preparing workers for jobs, preparing students for the workforce. And I'd like to turn this to you, Catherine Bergeron. I'm wondering, is the goal of education really to prepare people for the workforce, or is there something more to it than that?
Well, I was talking about the history of liberal education earlier, and I could return to that point to say that the goal of liberal education in America, as it has been historically conceived, was always to create leaders for liberal democracy, right? That's the higher end goal. We are a government by the people. And how can you be self-governed if you do not have an educated citizenry who is not only able to govern themselves individually, but also to make judgments based on complex pieces of data about complex issues, making judgments for other people, right? And so a liberal education is designed to give students that kind of capacity, and actually to foster a sense of responsibility for the world. You know, Brown's mission statement, since you mentioned your mission statement, begins with the mission is to serve the community, the nation, and the world, and ultimately to create the students who will lead lives of usefulness and reputation. And those words come from the original charter in the 18th century. And I do feel that Brown has actually held on to that mission in a fervent way with students who really don't want to just get ahead, but actually want to change the world.
But and if not every employer is going to do what TACO has done and promote from within, develop their own workforce, and help people to move up within the workforce, then what happens to students who follow the path that you mentioned, David Abbott, where you finish high school, you get some sort of post-secondary training, but you don't go on and get a bachelor's degree? Are those students going to be left behind eventually?
Well, you know, an interesting statistic is that in Rhode Island, this comes from the Poverty Institute, a third of our English language learners are first generation, a third are second generation, and a third are third generation. And I think that's a fairly chilling statistic, because you have to break the cycle at some point. You know, we've got one of the lowest educational attainment levels, in certainly the lowest in New England, and you know, that's an area where we really don't compare favorably across the country. And so we really just have to pick up the mantle that this is a generation where now the expectation is going to be that everyone needs to exit high school skilled enough to be prepared to enter a career readiness track or go on to college and beyond. And it just, it isn't our expectation. And so I think the answer to your question is you get exactly what we've got right now, which is an undereducated adult potential workforce, and you know, 22% dropout rate, and a lot of folks who feel like, yeah, our schools are terrible, but my school's great. It's the poverty of low expectations, and it's a vicious cycle. And it's going to take a real concerted effort to break out of that, because we don't really know in this country what we want our public education system to look like. We just know that it isn't meeting our expectations from the inside as an industry. But what does it look like? What does it look like? What does excellence and high expectations look like at scale? You know, there's no place in the country you can go and say, that's the model. Mm-hmm. That's where it's working. And sure, you can go to Singapore, Finland, and see examples of what high expectations look like in a more insular culture. But what does it look like here, where we have those expectations for everyone, and we're not weeding kids out, you know, at the middle school or the secondary level, where we expect every student to get to the end of that and have it be a meaningful entry into the next stage of their lives?
I guess I'm asking, are we setting our expectations too low, in a sense,
yes,
by saying that an associate's degree would be enough, or some sort of certificate post-high school would be enough? Because for a student who follows that track, wouldn't there be a limit to how far they can advance in their career?
Elizabeth, I'd like to take that question, because I think what you're going to find out, when you look statistically at Rhode Island, the thing that we've done the poorest job at is produce enough of those middle-range employees, or those people who are trained in the middle ranges at the associate degree level. The associate degree has become a valuable tool for many employers in terms of making sure that, one, the individual has the ability to continually learn. That's what that associate degree is evidence of. And two, that they bring a technical proficiency skill to the table. Honestly, Rhode Island needs to produce more associate degree graduates with those skills. And I asked the following question rhetorically, because I know the answer. You know, if you had envisioned that your car would have more computing power than we sent to, you know, man to the moon on in the Apollo mission, but it does. When you leave here tonight in your automobile, you're leaving with more computing power than that space mission. If you thought of an automotive technician as an associate degree candidate 30 years ago, people would have said, you're crazy. But that's exactly what it takes in terms of electronic diagnostic skills, in terms of understanding the basics of Ohm's law and Watt's law. And your auto technician is basically a computer technician. That's what they are. And so more and more, we need to find ways as a state and as a nation to produce more associate degree grads for those middle range jobs, not less.
And John White, I see you nodding your head here. I mean, as an employer, would you prefer to have an employee with a bachelor's degree or an associate's degree?
Oh, I don't really care. I mean, because the degree is, I got a degree. Okay, I'm not sure what that measures other than the ability of people to learn. People will learn if given the opportunity. So I think it's more relevant in my case to look at what they're going to do with what they learn. But I have a question for you. I have a question because I listened to that conversation, and I have always wondered this. I have two boys. They're both in their 20s and finished with school. And I was fortunate. They were having a horrible time in public school through fifth grade. Nothing was happening particularly good for them. It wasn't the school's fault necessarily. I was fortunate enough to be able to pull them out and put one at Moses Brown and one went to St. Andrews, and they both absolutely landed in these places and hit the road. I mean, that was the end of it. They never looked back. They love school. They love to learn. They love to achieve, and they both did. And I thought to myself, maybe this is a private-public issue, right? But then I got involved with some of the charter schools. They're public schools. Now, you asked if we had to go out and find a place that was nirvana in the education world. We couldn't. But I don't know if I agree, because these charter schools seem to do pretty well. And I'm just curious as to, and maybe I'm wrong about all this, but I'm just curious as to what is the difference and how maybe could that be transitioned over to the public school system somehow?
Well, we certainly hope so. And I didn't, what I think you missed the last two words of my sentence, which were at scale. Mm-hmm. And that's really the key. What we haven't figured out, there's great teaching and learning going on right here in Rhode Island.
I know that.
You know, some in the traditional public schools, some Absolutely. In charter schools, some in private schools. It's not that we don't know what good teaching looks like, but we really don't know how to scale it up so that every student is being challenged in every classroom by an excellent teacher whose primary focus is facilitating learning, not teaching. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so you see it happening, sure. But do you see it happening everywhere in any single school district? And the answer, unfortunately, is no. You know, we haven't been able to kind of brand and scale up excellence the way that you periodically see happening, you know, the Jack Welch years at GE. You know, he branded an international corporation and left his mark on it, which is still there. I know because my brother works there. But, you know, it's we really haven't turned that corner yet. And I don't think it's intractable. If I did, I'd go back and do something else. But it's elusive. And basically, the answer is that in education, probably as much or more than any other, and I will call it an industry, you have to get everything right. You can't get any one critical area. You can't even be weak in one area, or everything seems to slide off the table. Mm-hmm. And so what's the answer? How do you raise that level of performance and functionality across the board and maintain it and not have it personality driven? You know, and I think that's where our industry is struggling right now.
You know, and also you asked about, I'm sorry, just one quick thing about whether I would rather have a, what do you say?
Would you rather, when a, for example,
associates or a bachelor's?
When what I'm hearing just to give an example, nursing is a career where it used to be, you know, an associate's degree was enough, but I'm hearing more and more that hospitals want nurses with a bachelor's degree. And so I'm curious, is that true in other industries as well? Does a bachelor's degree signify more?
I think I was a little flippant when I said I didn't care, because I was thinking of a little bit broader subject. But of course, in an environment like mine, I've got jobs that I'm trying to fill that require an extended education, engineering or manufacturing engineering. I mean, these I do expect. You know, I can only hire the best, right? So the education for those folks, I would expect to be at a high level.
So I guess my question, maybe Stephen Kitchen, maybe you have some thoughts on this. When students are preparing so specifically for one job, auto mechanic, or you know, an associate's degree as a nurse, how do you make sure that other avenues are still open to them if, as David Abbott says, you know, we're likely in this day and age to change careers many times?
The real focus for our institution is that we are not the perfect place for everyone. And that when a student makes a decision to choose one of the 40 associate, bachelor's, or master's degree programs at our institution, they understand that it is a focused education. That the outcome, again, mission and purpose, the outcome to transition them from education to the world of work is paramount. So if you come to New England Tech to take surgical technology, you know that you're going to be in an environment where you're working with patients in surgery and doctors and nurses in surgery. So we do everything we can at the front end to make sure the student is very clear about what the expectations at the end of their education will be. And that is, you have selected automotive technology, you've selected mechanical engineering, you've selected occupational therapy, that is where you're headed. And indeed, some students make a decision, two or three quarters, we're on a quarter system at our institution, and some of them make that decision that two or three quarters in, we have some mechanisms to adjust for them. It's called an applied technical studies degree, so that they can still leave with an associate degree at the end of their studies. But the bottom line is, it's very important on the front end to make sure that they understand they're getting into a very focused, career-specific occupation. That doesn't mean, however, occupationally, that they're limited to being a manager or that they're limited to be, you know, they're limited to that function. But it does mean that that's the environment that they're going to operate in.
Okay, well, we have about 5 minutes left. So to close things off, I'd like to go around and just hear from all of you what you think are the two most important things that schools should do to prepare students for the workplace. And I'll start it off with you, Steve Kitchen.
The first thing, and it's one that I didn't experience in my days in high school, guidance counselors are a critical component of academic success for students. But I know this. When I sat down and told, and you wouldn't know it based upon my use of the microphone this evening, but I wanted to pursue a career in radio and television broadcasting. That's what I wanted to do. And I know that I wasn't told by my guidance counselor, don't do that. You'll never get a job. You know, you're not going to be successful. So we've not been good over time at using empirical labor market information to make good decisions about post-secondary ed. And I would say if we could do one thing better at the K through 12 area, particularly at that middle school to high school range, is let's use some empirical, let's help the student understand that, yes, it's nice that you might want to be an NBA star, but here are the labor market statistics that indicate you might have a problem with that career at 5'2". So I would just suggest we need to use labor market information better.
And John Hazen-White Jr.?
Yeah, I would suggest that I concur with the advisor idea, the guidance counselor advisor, at some point a little later on. I think at the elementary level, if there's a way that we can get these kids to enjoy being there and being a part of the, not the education system, but the learning world, then I think we will have conquered a huge huge thing.
Catherine Bertrand, what do you think?
I think it's essential that students learn nuanced communication skills in more than one language, including computer languages. I think it's essential that they that we create more opportunities for students to learn outside the classroom, to do things outside the classroom and then connect it with their learning. And I would also want to say that I think it's essential that we foster a sense of responsibility to the community and the world as part of any education.
And David Abbott, Rhode Island Deputy Commissioner of Education.
Two things. One, every decision made in school districts should be made on behalf of students, for students, in the students' interest, period. If students need more time, more instruction, more support, then we should be figuring out a way to do that rather than squeezing kids into the model we have. And two, we need to have high expectations for all students, and that means everyone, not just folks in the public education field. But that needs to spread. That needs to be politically, community-based. Parents, I'm always shocked at how low some parents' expectations are for their own children.
This has been a special broadcast of Policy in Peno, recorded before a live audience at the Providence Athenaeum. I'd like to thank all of our guests, David Abbott, Rhode Island Deputy Commissioner of Education, Catherine Bergeron from Brown University, John Hazen-White Jr. of TACO, Inc., and Stephen Kitchen from New England Institute of Technology. Thank you all so much for being here, and a special thank you to the Providence Athenaeum for hosting us, and Rhode Island Public Radio General Manager Joe O'Connor. Thank you very much. I'm Elizabeth Harrison.